This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
Good morning. It's Thursday, May the 19th, 2022. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown, coming to you on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. Let's hit the horns and go. On the show today, Shauna Pilupchuk from the Alberta Disability Workers Association will discuss the staffing shortage for people with disabilities in the province. Stephen Scott of Double Tap Canada will share some details about the new leases. Sylvie Fiquette will be here for the Pacific Regional Report. She'll talk about a new documentary about a rejected inclusive housing project in South Surrey, British Columbia. Don Dickinson will be here to preview the injured in a car crash. And community reporter Becky Czar will chat about some family fun activities offered by the Saskatoon Forestry Farm Park and Zoo. Taking a walk on the wild side with Becky's Prairie Politics, Alberta Premier Jason Kenney narrowly survived a leadership vote amongst his own party, but resigned the position atop the United Conservative Party. Nonetheless, Kenney captured 51.4% support from party members. Secretary of the United Conservative Party, Janice Nett, says the results are the results.
I mean, we have to respect the members. We're a member-driven party, and the results are what they are, and we need to move forward. So it's a mandate to move forward. I am personally sad to see Mr. Kenney leave. I believe that he was a very strong leader, and he had the potential to really move this province forward.
Conrad Van Heerden, Constituency Association President for Livingstone McLeod, says he knew the vote would be close.
At the end, we wanted unity, and but 51 or 52% or whatever the number is, I don't think it would have been that. I respect Jason's decision. It's going to be tough probably going forward for a bit. A lot of people, a lot of work into it. But we need to unite as a party, and we need to find a leader that can do that. Right now, we're divided.
Kenney has asked the party to expedite a leadership vote, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in our daily poll, but I've got a few more news stories for you before we get there. Let's turn to the world of federal politics, where Conservative finance critic Ed Fast says he's troubled by leadership hopeful Pierre Poilievre's suggestion he would fire the Bank of Canada governor over the country's inflation rate. Fast says what he finds disturbing is Poilievre appearing to challenge the independence of the institution.
Central Bank has served us well, not perfectly over the years, but has served us well in keeping inflation in check. Central banks around the world have struggled with the same challenges that our central bank has struggled with.
Fast further reflected on the separation of fiscal policy by the government and the monetary policy of the central bank.
The independence of one of our key monetary institutions is critical. I would be very careful about tampering with that institution.
Poilievre pitched the idea of firing Bank of Canada Governor Tiff Macklem in a leadership debate last week. He has dismissed criticism of his proposal as merely political elites attacking his message. I want to move to the world of provincial potty mouth politicians. You know I love stories like this. Two members of Saskatchewan's legislature were kicked out of the House for language they used, then refusing to apologize. How dare they? An NDP leader was kicked out for using a swear word, and an independent member was kicked out for saying the government's COVID-19 restrictions were a crime. Premier Scott Moe says all party members need to do better.
And this is a place to debate policy, not personalities. And I think it would do everyone good to just pause for a moment and remember that.
Mo acknowledged that leaders have to set the standard.
With respect to being the leader of the government side, we most certainly need to set the example. And I think throughout the session, we largely have. It hasn't been without blemish.
I'm always interested by the bells that ring there. Sam Robinson just got in my ear and said, I think that's the fire alarm. I think it's actually the bells they use to call the politicians back to the legislature. I think that's what's going on there. And I find it so funny that, like, it's schools and provincial legislatures and the halls of parliament where we need bells to remind people to be places on time. Let's take a look at what the royals are up to. Prince Charles and Camilla are spending the final day of the royal visit in Canada's north after a whirlwind stop in the nation's capital. Laura Osman is on the trail.
The Prince and Duchess were greeted by crowds all around Ottawa yesterday. The royals packed a dozen events into their busy schedule.
They're living fairy tale, really.
Robert Hoop introduced the couple to his maple syrup products in the Byward Market, where they were swarmed with crowds. Today, the couple has another busy day in the Northwest Territories, with stops meant to continue the trip's focus on climate change, literacy, and Crown Indigenous relations. Laura Osmond, The Canadian Press, Ottawa.
Let's get to our daily polls. At AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you find us on Facebook. Yesterday, we asked you what kind of overcrowded place annoys you the most. 22% of you said a store, 11% of you said a restaurant, 67% of you said public transit, and 0% of you said, I like crowds. So good to know that we are amongst those who like a little bit of breathing room, both around the studio and around the world. Daily poll for today. And of course, this relates to Jason Kenney offering up his resignation as leader of the UCP last night. When a premier or prime minister steps down, how much time should pass before an election is called? Immediately, once a new leader is chosen, or there's no urgency? And I can already hear some of you negative Nellies out there, or negative Nathans out there, not to gender negativity, saying, you know, Dave, in Canadian politics, we don't vote for premiers or the prime minister. We vote for parties and learn this political system, you jabroni. Okay, then why do we have leadership debates? Like, why do we even bother putting the leaders up on stage if we're not considering these people important to the process? So that's why I asked the question. Yes, I understand how the system works, but let's be clear. Leaders play a critical role in this democracy. And when somebody cast a vote for the UCP in the last Alberta election, they were essentially casting a vote for Jason Kenney and his policies. Why do you think when we're looking at all the ads going on right now in the Ontario election, specifically the PC ads, are littered with Doug Ford's name? Like, it's vote for Doug Ford. He's going to get the job done. That's the messaging. So, yeah, I understand what you're going to say to me. Democracy. Yeah, but guess what? Like, the way in which it's written in a constitution somewhere is not the way it plays out in practice. So zip it and answer my question. Let's go to Alberta Insider, Sam Robinson. I say Alberta Insider because you have lots of in-laws and family out in that neck of the woods.
Oh, and they were texting me last night. That's how I found out.
I suspect they were.
Yeah.
But answer my question first, and then I want to kind of take the temperature of Alberta.
You know, I don't think that in a time where we have easy air travel that we should ever accept a kind of lame duck session. In the modern world, that there is no reason to have really a delay in anybody. I was thinking of this because for some reason I was rewatching a part of The Wire the other day, and you know they're doing this police meeting, and one of the police majors gets fired in public at this meeting, and I was just thinking about how like when they fire him, they ask him, "Is your deputy present?" Yes, he stands up. You're the next one. Mm-hmm. So who is the next in line for Jason Kenney? And he should have already thought about that as a result, or it should be required if he's going to resign, that he has a deputy to take the place.
Yeah.
At least for governance's sake.
I'm sure we'll learn more about that today. I mm-hmm. believe it was Kelvin Gutzen who took over for Brian Pallister in Manitoba before Heather Stephenson eventually won the leadership race. So mm-hmm. there will be an interim premier named, and then when the UCP picks a new leader, that person will indeed yeah. become the premier until there's an election, which I believe is scheduled for next year. Mm-hmm. I believe it was 2019 that Kenny and the UCP won that election. Now, Sam, I want to stick with you a little bit longer here because yeah. we did see the results of this leadership vote, 51.4%. Mm-hmm. It's a struggle in Alberta right now to sort of keep a united conservative movement. And as we talked about with Craig Oliver on the show yesterday, we're not looking at ancient history about divisions inside that movement in the province.
Last election.
Like, we're talking about the UCP coming together from the Conservatives and Wild Rose Party to form the UCP in the last election because they were all stunned by the idea that the NDP formed government in Alberta, as I think a lot of people were rather stunned. But yeah, so like, when we're talking about 51.4%, mm-hmm. there's no way this leadership debate doesn't get a little bit ugly. And whether there's going to be some fractures that exist as well.
Yeah, trending right now too is Brian Jean in the hour before I actually do the trending report today. But Brian Jean is trending because that was his competitor for the most part. So it'll be interesting to see their reasoning behind it too, because a lot of what they're talking about is we need somebody to get in place now and build them up so that they can defeat the NDP coming up next year.
So, by the way, I didn't answer my own question after going on my own preamble. I would say once a new leader is chosen is probably the appropriate answer there, but I wouldn't object to the concept of saying, hey, you stepped down, immediate election. But again, after my preamble that I just gave you about how important leaders are in the way in which we do democracy right now, you should give people an opportunity, but there should not be much lead up time between one and the other, right?
Sure.
Once that new leader is chosen, boom, let's get back into the cycle here.
Yeah, sure.
And then there's some extenuating circumstances. Like if, for example, somebody becomes ill or passes away, I'm going to give a little bit more leeway and wiggle room, but I think this one was a little bit predictable. And we're also right on the verge of an election in Alberta.
So is this more of a question about whether or not we should let parties fulfill their terms after a mandate, or he's gone, that we should have an immediate new election?
I would suggest that because there's been a changeover in leadership, or there's a concept of a changeover in leadership, that voters didn't necessarily get the bag they paid for.
Right. Okay.
I do think that matters, right? I think in democracy it matters. Now, as you know, I'm a big proponent of electoral reform, generally speaking, in this country. Yeah. So that could be tinged a little bit in my overall view of electoral reform.
Or, just rose-colored glasses,
Or wild rose-colored glasses as well that I might have. Hey, Mike Ross, we're not meaning to exclude you from this conversation. I want to bring you in here, and I want to give you the opportunity to sort of maybe reflect a little bit on the news out of Alberta yesterday. But let's jump into my question first, and then we can attack the news a little bit.
Well, Dave, this is where I have to give you a bit of a civics lesson, because in Canada, we don't vote for the prime minister or the premier. We vote for our representatives, Dave. But I'm saying that sort of half jokingly, but I'm saying that also half seriously, because in the case of where I live right now, I could easily vote either Liberal or Conservative. But I'm also looking at the leader of the party and thinking, well, I can't vote for one of these guys. There's one that I just will not vote for. And the other one, I don't really know that well. And so my history has almost exclusively been voting directly for the person who is going to represent me. Secondarily, I look at the platform of the party and listen to what that candidate has to say about the platform of the party.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's a weird, like we just have a weird system far as, policies and leaders of parties. And, are we actually running on that person's policy? No, most times the policy that's put forward, the platform is put forward by the party at a convention.
The whipping of the message, right? The debate that moderated on Tuesday night, all three party members were really strong on sticking to their party's platform in the way they answered my questions.
And that platform is usually established by the membership of the party before an election. They have these annual conventions. I know when I was a card-carrying member of a party, I was 17 years old and I went to my first political convention, a policy convention, and went through all those exercises. So I know that it's easy to sort of write off the leader as being the not only the messenger in the face, but the person who's actually bringing forth the ideas. I think clearly in many instances in provincial politics in this country right now, the ideas aren't really coming from the people who are the face of their parties or their governments. That's how I sort of parse it up for me. It really is about the direct representative for me. I think if I voted for example, where I live, Rod Phillips, former minister in the Ford government, who put out that famous Christmas video a couple of years ago.
The Minister of Travel and Tourism.
That he was at home when you could clearly hear the waves crashing on the beach in the background. He stepped down. I believed that at that point we should have had a by-election, because we are no longer being represented by the person that was duly elected. So let's have a by-election. When it comes to the party leadership, the party itself, the whole party was elected by, electing these representatives who represented a platform. So I don't think there's a big rush necessarily to go to a general election. Mm-hmm. If you want to have a by-election for that individual seat, no problem. If that person's resigning completely from politics, and have a by-election. But I don't think you need to have a general election.
Mike, I think we may get jammed up a little bit for time here. So I tell you what, let's reflect a little bit on the Alberta political situation, particularly in the next hour of the show after the regional news updates.
You got it.
That's Mike Ross. He'll be back a little bit later in the show. In the meantime, you can vote on the poll at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. And you can listen to Sam Robinson tell you what's going on in the world of weather.
Thank you, Dave. And here we are with our National Weather Report from Environment Canada today. Starting off as we usually do in St. John's, Newfoundland, where we've got increasing cloudiness early this morning. High, 11 degrees. Over to Halifax, mainly sunny this morning. The high, 17. Into Montreal, increasing cloudiness. Rain beginning this morning. And the high, 13 degrees. Up to Ottawa, cloudy this morning, a few showers ending this afternoon, the high 14 degrees. Over to Toronto, a few showers ending this morning, then cloudy, the high 22 degrees. Up to Thunder Bay, it's cloudy this morning, 40% chance of drizzle, and the high 10 degrees. Moving over to Winnipeg, cloudy this morning, rain beginning this afternoon, the high 14 degrees. Over to Saskatoon, becoming cloudy this morning with showers. Wind from the northeast, 40 gusting to 60 near noon, the high 11 degrees. Moving over to Alberta, cloudy in Calgary this morning. Rain as well, the high 8 degrees. Up to Edmonton, periods of rain ending near noon, then cloudy, 60% chance of showers. Risk of a thunderstorm early this afternoon, the high 12 degrees. Up to the territories, in Yellowknife, it's sunny this morning, the high 13 degrees. Down to BC, and in Vancouver, mainly sunny, the high 13. And finally, in Victoria, a mix of sun and cloud this morning, the high 13 degrees. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
It was nice of Yellowknife to have such nice weather for the Royals today.
Yes. You know,
if you're going to come visit the Royals, you got to make sure you give the weather the appropriate.
And to have nice weather for the rest of us who are having cloudy, rainy weather across the country.
Oh, it was lovely walking in today. Almost no sweating. Sam, thank you for this.
Cheers.
Coming up next, Shauna Palupchuk from the Alberta Disability Workers Association will discuss the staffing shortage going on in Alberta and how that can impact people with disabilities. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. We spent most of the first segment today talking about news out of Alberta. Well, here's another story involving Alberta. The Alberta Disability Workers Association has launched a campaign calling on the provincial government to take action on a shortage of workers. To tell you more about the campaign, Essential But Forgotten, is Shauna Palupchuk, board president of the ADWA, and joining us this morning from Edmonton. Hey, Shauna, thank you for making time to be with us today. We're grateful.
Great. Thanks for inviting us, Dave.
So, Shauna, we in the media like to use buzzwords, and worker shortage is one that certainly is working its way through a lot of headlines and articles and conversations these days. But I wonder if you can paint the picture for us a little bit about the worker shortage in Alberta right now.
Okay. What's happening is within the community disability services workforce, we've had, like over the pandemic, it's been a long haul, and we fought very hard to be designated as essential. And the hashtag or the slogan of essential but forgotten is basically just, you know, people are burnt out. And with the increases in cost, we're finding that people are leaving the sector. They're choosing positions outside of the community disability services area. Even if the pay isn't that much better, it's really that they're burnt out, they feel undervalued, and that we haven't seen an increase since 2014.
I imagine that the answer to this is fairly self-evident, but tell me more about how this shortage is impacting people with disabilities.
Well, one of the things that we're facing and why we're, you know, we're really talking about it, and not just us as the workforce, but we're also collaborating with our allies and community partners. So we've met with self-advocates, we've met with families, we've met with employers, and we're all working together in this campaign in order to bring awareness to it. Because what people are finding now is as workers are choosing to leave this positions, we have the middle managers trying to fill, in some cases, working 72 hours straight nonstop to fill vacancies. And now they're getting to the point where there is nobody to recruit into those positions. And when that happens, then there's no service to provide to individuals. We've had cases and situations throughout Alberta where organizations have had to go to families and say, we can no longer provide this service because we can't staff it. Mm. And so families are having to, in one case in Alberta, a gentleman had to move to BC to live with his brother because the service that was available to him was no longer available.
I imagine there are short-term and long-term solutions to this. Let's start with the short-term. What would you like the government and I suppose other related agencies to be doing in the short-term to start bridging this gap?
Right. So, and that's part of what our campaign is. We're looking on, we need immediate crisis intervention. And we see that as because of inflation and because what we're hearing. So ADWA did a survey with people who work in the sector. And what we're hearing is they cannot afford to raise a family, even working two jobs. So we need an influx of the increase in wages. We have the average wage of $18.76, which compared to some provinces, as the minister, our minister will say, is, well, you know, that's pretty good. But not in Alberta, not when you're competing for higher wages in sectors or in retail or in service industries that don't have the same type of responsibilities associated with them. Mm-hmm. So we need an influx. We need an influx to try to keep and retain the people that we have. And then over the long term, we need to increase the awareness and the desire for people to choose this as a career. And one of the things that we need to do is we need to have a certification process. We lost our post-secondary programs over a period of time because of the low wages. So why would you invest in going to become educated if when you get out of a two-year diploma, you're not making much more at that time than a Tim Hortons employee?
What's you may have mentioned it, Shauna, I apologize, but what's the target increase that you're calling for?
Well, what we did was we, so we're not a union, right? We're not a union. We're more of a professional association that is that advocates for workers in the community disability services sector. So we did a survey of our members. So purely anecdotal in what would it take, right? What would it take for you to stay in this position? And on average, we saw about a 25% increase in their wages. That they felt was an increase enough that they would be able to afford to work one position and be able to raise their family. Whereas now they're finding themselves working more than one job, and even that isn't sustainable.
Yeah, it's something that we explored a little bit, especially during the pandemic, when there were some restrictions on in-home visits that people could do. And we were also finding there were many individuals that were having to go to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 clients a day just to try and make ends meet, which seems unreasonable when the care needs to be so personalized.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it's about relationships. Right. Like these are people's homes, and Albertans with disabilities have a right to live their lives as all citizens, and they shouldn't have to have a rotating door of staff not knowing who is coming in that next day. So it's about relationships. And that was, you know, we have many stories of staff that are just heartbroken when they're faced with that decision of, do I stay because I love what I do, but I can't afford to do this anymore.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's really, you know, it's kind of like, and it's not the first crisis we've had this in. This community disability services, we kind of cycle in and out of that same crisis in and out. So we're the long term, we're asking for sustainable, predictable funding so that organizations can continue with cost of living to increase wages rather than us having to go back every, you know, 6, 7, 8 years to try to get increases again.
Yeah.
And the last time, you know, in our Facebook pages, all of the rallies we did in Alberta in 2000, 9 years ago, you know, we're popping up with the pictures and we're back at it again.
Mm. Shauna, we spent some time in the first segment talking about the somewhat wacky landscape of Alberta politics right now. But have you had any response from the provincial governments or partners?
Yeah, so our ministry talks about some of the long term. So we absolutely are recognize the long term investment that they've done. So they've recently given a grant to Alberta Council of Disability Services to look at some research around it and also to look at ways to develop a workforce strategy. And so we very much collaborate with Alberta Council and we work with them. But again, that's a long-term solution, and we are going to be part of that long-term solution, but we also need more immediate asks. We need immediate attention. We fought to even just be recognized as essential workers, and people are burnt out, and they feel, and I think that's why it's so heightened right now, is they feel so undervalued over the last 2 years. Some were getting the critical worker benefits, some weren't. And so we had to fight for them, for everybody to get it. It's been such a challenge and just educating the government. Like every time we, you know, somebody would speak to their MLA, they have no idea what this workforce is. Mm. And even though that this workforce in Alberta is not a unionized, right? So most of the 85% of the organizations are purely funded by the government. So the wages of workers is dependent on the government funding. And that is, you know, it's sad because the government itself doesn't really understand what this workforce is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Shauna, the Essential But Forgotten campaign, where can folks go to learn more or offer up their support?
Oh, absolutely. So our website is www.adwa.ca. And right on our landing page, on our homepage, you'll find a button called Essential But Forgotten. And one of the things that we do as a professional association is we really, not only do we advocate for, but we're also really invested in empowering people to advocate for themselves. So in that area on our website, we provide sample letters for people. For workers to send to their MLA. We're providing as much information. And we have a lot of people who are ADWA members that are doing things on their own. We've had a lot of people meet with MLAs. We have we had a lady just yesterday send us a YouTube that wrote a song about her experiences. We have people connecting with media to tell their story. And that is so powerful, because that's really what we want, is we want to bring awareness to who the people are that do this work and the people that they provide services to. We have families and individuals that are so supportive and also want to tell their stories.
Shauna, thank you for enlightening us this morning on this really important topic.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for giving us the opportunity, Dave.
That's Shauna Pilupchuk, the president of the Alberta Disability Workers Association. Essential But Forgotten is the campaign they're running right now. Coming up next, Dawn Dickinson will be here with a preview of The Guardian this week. She has an article on a new study that finds women are almost twice as likely to be injured in a car crash. Dawn will take a look at some of the details there with you and with me in just a couple of moments on Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI This Week. Let's get to a preview of The Guardian this week. Saturdays, noon Eastern, 12 p.m. for that reading show. Dawn Dickinson is the producer of the program and joins us now to let you know about a couple of the interesting articles you can hear. Hey, Dawn, how are you?
I am good, Dave. Very good.
I think I had a little slip there as I welcomed folks back. I think I called it AMI This Week, a show that I haven't been on in like 5 years, and yet somehow still built into the lexicon of my tongue. Dawn, let's
check. Early.
It's early. It's always early. Dawn, let's jump into a study here for your first article about car crashes and women's health and injuries that women are facing. In fact, women twice as likely to end up being injured in a car crash. So what are some of the finer details of this research?
Well, I found this really fascinating. Not only are they twice as likely, to be trapped, but they're also receiving different types of injuries when they have these car crashes. The research, the first large UK study to compare sex differences in injury patterns and collision, could help vehicle manufacturers improve car design and safety features to reduce rates of injury in both sexes. Mm. It also strengthens calls for the inclusion of more biologically accurate crash test dummies in simulations of vehicle collisions to investigate their impact on women. So, yeah, a double factor there that's very, very crucial.
Dawn, you mentioned this was the biggest study of its kind. What instigated it?
Well, Professor Tim Nutbeam, I love that name, an emergency medicine consultant at University Hospitals Plymouth, and colleagues were motivated to carry out the study after reading Carolyn Perez's best-selling book, Invisible Woman, which highlighted how women were more likely to be seriously injured in car crashes because crash test dummies are modeled on the average male height and the average male weight.
So in the end, how did they conduct this study? I'm always interested by methodology.
Yeah, so to investigate, they looked at data from 70,000 patients admitted to major trauma centers and units in the UK from January 2012 all the way to December 2019. They found that although men were more likely to be involved in serious crashes and admitted to hospital, 16% of women became trapped in the wreckage versus only 9% of men. Women also sustained more hip and spinal injuries, whereas men suffered more head, chest, face, and limb injuries. The research was published in the BMJ Open. So they really found distinct differences, and that's what I found very interesting, Dave. Now, you know, being my size, because I'm just shy of 6 foot, and, you know, I would probably fall in the male category when it came to those injuries, right? But, you know, most women aren't, so.
Yeah, that's the recommendation, Dawn, that I think you mentioned kind of in the first answer, which says we need to be more up to date in using these crash test dummies that are more biologically representative, which will then allow car designers to design better seat belts, better seats, better airbags, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, it falls into that category that we're always talking about, Dave, where most of the research in all fields is done in a sort of male-oriented way, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously that's changing in medicine now. You know, they're doing more studies of like how heart attacks affect females versus males and things like that. But it's something that has to be looked into basically in all fields.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, Dawn, we go from a very important story to something that's a teensy bit lighter, unless I suppose the person involved in this trade is listening. There is a story here about a painting called Black Truck by Nova Scotian artist Maude Lewis. The painting, 50 years old, but getting a little bit of buzz recently. Dawn, why is this story so buttered up?
Oh, I love this story. Black Truck was by Nova Scotia artist Maude Lewis. And I was going to say we all know Maude, but I mean, I'm hoping that most Canadians know Maude.
There was a movie about her in 2017, as I recall.
Yes. And that movie brought huge exposure to her work. And that, of course, contributed to this particular story because this painting sold for 10 times its assessed value, setting a new high mark for a painter whose popularity has basically surged in recent years. Lewis lived in poverty most of her life, unfortunately, and her output as a painter declined in her final years as the effects of rheumatoid arthritis took hold. But while she, you know, was painting, her and her husband often sold paintings by the roadside to tourists visiting Nova Scotia. Her distinct and cheery work did not receive international acclaim until decades after her death.
So one of these roadside sales ended up being pretty low stakes. Tell me about how a sandwich comes into play here.
Well, this was just so Canadian, you know. Irene Dumas, who as a young chef acquired the work in exchange for a grilled cheese sandwich. She and her husband, Tony, had an arrangement with the artist John Kinnear that in exchange for grilled cheese sandwiches at lunchtime, they would be able to choose from a selection of small paintings by Kinnear and in some cases, some of his friends. One morning in 1973, Kinnear brought in a series by Maud, who he had a relationship with. And of course, it had a very distinctive look to it. And she liked it and she purchased it but traded it, for this sandwich. Among them was, of course, this one called Black Truck. And it hung in Irene Dumas's house for 5 decades.
Wow.
Okay. So, and then, of course, came up for sale and did amazingly well. So I think we're going to see a lot more coming out of a lot more of these particular stories coming out of Nova Scotia, because I'm sure she was quite prolific when she was painting. So I'm sure there's probably little paintings hanging in little houses all over Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that bread was artisan and the cheese was pretty bougie, because it turned out to be a pretty expensive sandwich. It's kind of like the story of the guy who gave 2 bitcoins for a Domino's pizza about 10 years ago, and those 2 bitcoins now worth like tens of thousands of dollars. So, you know, that's how these things go sometimes, Don. We get in these speculative trades. Hey, Don, have a great day, have a great long weekend, and we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Thanks very much, Dave. You too.
That's
bye-bye.
Don Dickinson, the producer of The Guardian This Week. You can find the show Saturdays at 12 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. You can find Mike Ross down the highway for the big business story of the day. So, Mike, I know you've got 2 stories here. Which one do you want to start with?
Well, I'll give you the breaking news first, which is that Global Live and TELUS have signed a network sharing deal. Global Live Capital says it has signed a network and spectrum sharing agreement with TELUS, and that now is telling analysts that it's reinforcing the idea that they are going to bid to purchase Freedom Mobile, mm-hmm. which, of course, is part of that whole Rogers acquisition of Shaw. They need to shed Freedom Mobile. How do they do that? They sell it to somebody else.
And to one of the other big telcos.
To one of the other telcos. That's right. So, you know, in an effort to maintain some kind of competitive balance across the country, it looks like TELUS is going to get into that game, and we'll see where it leads from here. Mm-hmm. So that's the breaking news this morning in the business world.
And the other one comes from the world of inflation.
Right. And this is one that I'm glad I was able to find here today, and we can briefly talk about it. And it's just that, you know, when you watch the news, you check out any article online about inflation right now, what do you hear about? You hear about high gas prices and you hear about food prices and how expensive food is because, well, high gas prices is now pushing food prices even higher. It's leading to shortages at the grocery store, et cetera, et cetera. But the one thing that really started hitting home but way back during the pandemic and continues to be even a bigger issue now is food insecurity in this country. Mm-hmm. So people who already were experiencing food insecurity and were relying on food banks, for example, they're hurting even more because there are food banks out there that are seeing cost increases of 30, 40, 50%, whether it's rent for their buildings, whether it's operational costs, and whether it's a downturn in contributions and donations from the general public. And so that food insecurity is going to become an even bigger problem the longer this inflation number sticks around. And of course, Stats Canada said consumers paid 9.7% more for food at stores in April compared to a year ago. That's the largest increase in food prices a year over year in a month since September of 1981.
Mm-hmm.
You're going back a long way. Stats Can, or the 2020 Canadian Income Survey also found that 11.2% of Canadian homes live some kind of moderate or severe food insecurity. So I think it's important that those of us who, you know, aren't wanting necessarily, but are experiencing those higher prices, also just sort of keep in mind and remain aware that there are some people out there who have a lot less, and now that discrepancy and that chasm grows even wider. Yeah. Because of the cost of inflation.
There are degrees to the struggle. There's no doubt about that. Mike, thank you for this.
Okay, Dave.
That's Mike Ross with the big business story of the day. Coming up next, community reporter Becky Czar. We'll talk about some of the family fun activities offered by the Saskatoon Forestry Farm Park and Zoo. Getting the taste of the wild with Becky Czar. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's head back into the prairies to catch up with community reporter Becky Czar in Regina. Hey, good morning, Becky.
Good morning.
So, Becky, you've got a couple neat events lined up for us here that you want to highlight. And the first one sounds like you are once again playing to the dealer here. Poetry and a pint. What are the details here?
Yeah, you know what? I saw this one popped up on my Facebook page the other day, and I thought, you know what? That sounds kind of cool. I'm going to bring it forward because it's unlike anything I've talked about before. So it's taking place here in Regina, so you still have time to book your flight, Dave, this Saturday, May the 21st, from 3 to 4 p.m. So it's located at Bushwhackers Brew Pub right here in Regina. Most people who live here would know exactly where I'm talking. It's 2206 Dudney Avenue. And it's really cool because what it is an opportunity to come out and hear Saskatchewan's Poet Laureate, as well as six other poets as well, including the previous Poet Laureate as well. So that's kind of a cool experience, I think. I read their bios, and it's so diverse and unique, and I think it would be really interesting to sit back, grab a pint, or, you know, in my case, a glass of wine or beverage of your choice, and just have a good afternoon listen there. It's basically it's all Saskatchewan themed as well, which I thought was kind of cool too. Now, here's the thing, Dave, no tickets need to be purchased in advance. So it's based on first come, first serve seating. So, I mean, you don't have to rush the door or anything like that, I don't think, but you can go there, grab a seat. That gives you admission for free to listen to all of these amazing, talented poets. But the pint part of it, that comes out of your own pocket. So if you want to supplement, you know, have a pint there with you or another beverage of your choice and have maybe a snack or something to go along with it, those costs come out of your pocket as well. But that's kind of a fairly cheap Saturday afternoon entertainment. And we are expected here for our May long weekend to be a little bit soggy. So I thought something indoors might be a really good idea at this point in time. So if you want to find some more information, just head on over to the Saskatchewan Writers Guild. There's a plethora of information. All the amazing bios are posted on there as well at their website, which is www.saskwriter.com.
Becky, we've talked about this with a few community reporters and even a couple of contributors over the course of the last few years. Something like poetry sometimes is seen as very button up, right? It's very starched collar and stiff. It's nice when you start tearing down some of those expectations or restrictions that let people know, culture, poetry, music, this stuff can be fun.
Yeah, you know what? And by breaking it down and putting it into a different environment, we're not listening to it at a library or, you know, a poetry reading or whatever. I think it just opens the door for such a variety of people to join in. And as a person with vision loss, this is totally accessible in so many ways. So it's located downtown, which, you know, bus services makes it super easy as well. The listening component, easy peasy, right? And you have an opportunity to meet the actual writers. If this is your real interest, those people, you know, this is their lives. This is what they want to talk about as well. So I'm sure that they'd be happy to stick around and have a conversation with you, you know, after the show.
So we go from some fun activities indoors to a little bit more of a taste of the wild. The Saskatoon Forestry Farm Park and Zoo, it's now open. So why did this one jump out to you?
I love the Saskatoon Forestry Farm, Dave. Honestly, I'm surprised I haven't thought to talk about this before, because I could probably go, you know, if I lived in Saskatoon, I could probably go and hang out here every single day and probably experience a slightly different version of the zoo each time. And when I say zoo, okay, Dave, I have to be honest. We live in Saskatchewan, so our definition of a zoo is a little bit less expansive, let's say, than, you know, when some people think of zoo, they might think of, you know, giraffes and hippos, that type of thing. We're talking like
Becky, candidly, we shouldn't be having those animals in zoos in Canada.
Right. Absolutely. They don't belong. Right. So this is a little bit more, you know, bang on friendly. And I've actually, you know, it's kind of a refuge too for some animals who have become injured and just need a really safe place to live as well. So that's a really, you know, cool thing behind the scenes of the forestry farm as well, is they take in those animals that, you know, perhaps wouldn't survive on their own in the wild anymore because of injury or, you know, loss of their mom earlier on in their life and that type of thing. So it's, I mean, I diverge there.
No, but that's a good divergence, because it reminds me a lot of a local zoo that I used to hang out at in Montreal called the Eco Museum Zoo in Saint Anne de Bellevue, where that's exactly what it was. It was a refuge for regionally appropriate wild animals. So like lynxes and wolves and bears and like and wild birds and big birds. It was like super cool to experience animals that were appropriate to meet in that venue. There was also a porcupine. They made me get in the porcupine enclosure for a TV bit. I was not happy about that.
Oh God. I mean, you just raised my hair all over my body, because that just terrifies the crap out of me. But I agree. It's locally based animals that likely most of them you would see someplace in Saskatchewan in the wild as well. So I remember last time I was there, actually a wolf was behind the scenes, kind of, you know, in her enclosure. I'm going to say her, she was really pretty, but and she kind of followed me around back and forth. And I was like, I don't know if you want to be friends with me, or if you're, you know, looking at me as an appetizer, or what the deal was. Like, she wasn't posturing or anything, but it was just really interesting to see, you know, see her movement. She didn't care about my kid or my husband or anything like that. It was me that she was interested in, but maybe we had this motherly connection. I'm not sure. Anyways, it's open. It's ready to go 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. daily. Admission is basically $8.40 for kiddos, up to $14 for adults, which I think is fairly fair. That gets you in the door, access to see all of these amazing animals. I have to comment on the accessibility portion of it. The thing that really resonates in my mind is they have these really wide walking paths. And regardless if you are, you know, prefer, you know, walking with a cane, if you have a guide dog, or you prefer a sighted guide, there's enough room for people to, you know, go by you in both directions without you feeling like, oh my goodness, am I in the middle of these people? Am I, you know, slowing down the process of everybody getting by? That's something that really bothers me without being able to see properly. So I remember really appreciating this, that I could have my kid there, my son there, or my husband there, and we can all just sort of navigate our way through without feeling that level of stress as well. There's also a little train that you can jump on and off. And, you know, if you really want to get off and see these animals a little bit longer and linger at that spot, you can wait till the next train swings by and picks you up. I think they go by every 15 minutes or so. So if you have mobility issues, or you're getting a little bit tired from, you know, winding your way through these paths and seeing these animals, you can hop on this train and it'll take you in, you know, in this amazing magical ride throughout the little zoo as well. And if you happen to get hot or cold, because our Saskatchewan weather is very diverse, it seems to be these days, you can go inside and there's some amazing exhibits in there as well. while to cool down. I do have to say right now that a lot of the birds are not on display. They're not able to be seen right now because of precautions that have to do with the avian influenza outbreak that's happening here in North America. So yeah, it's amazing. I would highly encourage people, if you are in Saskatchewan and you haven't had an opportunity to check out our little forestry farm, please stop by. It's such an amazing, unique little site.
Becky, you mentioned that the wolf took interest in you. No birds right now because of the avian flu. That's well identified. But what's the animal that you think people need to make sure they check out if they visit the zoo?
Well, for me, I have to say it's monkeys. And I know that that is something we don't naturally have here. They are in their own little, you know, habitat and stuff like that, look, you know, being looked after. Usually this location has something that kind of comes on display-ish. But I have to say, for me, a bear is really intriguing.
Yeah.
Behind a fence. I don't want to see it in the natural wild. It terrifies me. They are too smart and really eager to, you know, consume my food as well. And I don't want to compete for that. So a bear behind a fence, because they're so well taken care of. Like, that's the thing. They don't look, you know, when I had sight, I used to go to the zoo as well. They don't look sad. They don't look, you know, well undernourished, or, you know, how they look stressed and stuff like that. They don't look like that here. They look happy and doing their thing, and they have their little cubs that come out every once in a while. And it's just like, it melts my heart, Dave. Honestly, I start the car, let's go up there and check it out again.
Bears are terrifying and adorable. Big fan over here as well. One of my favorite follows on social media is the Oregon Zoo. They have a couple rescue black bears, and every year during the heat wave in the summer, they bring out the big ice bucket and without fail show the bears splashing around in the ice bucket, sort of like an ice tub for the bears.
Yeah.
There's nothing like a bear sitting up like a human throwing ice at another bear. It's amazing. It's like the most wonderful thing that exists.
It's like flashback to my 3-year-old son.
Do they have goats at this particular zoo? Because goats are also quite charming.
Yes, they do. And you can feed the goats.
Oh.
They have this little, I know, right, Dave? It just keeps getting better. They have these little dispensers. You pay whatever, I don't know, like, it's probably inflation, right? Maybe a buck now. And you get a little bit of feed and you put it in your hand. And I actually have pictures of my son, my husband was there, you know, supervising, taking this feed in his hand and the little goat coming up and eating out of his hand.
And it's
appropriate food for them, right? It's not like you're handing them the popcorn out of your bucket, right? Mm-hmm, like, that's highly frowned upon, of course. But it's such a unique experience. I love goats. They're super cute, too.
One of the greatest experiences in my journalism life was getting to go to Bee Meadow Rescue Farm outside of Ottawa and spend some time in the goat enclosure. And I bonded with this one goat, sweet Annabelle, who chewed on my shorts all afternoon long.
Aww.
Becky, we got to get out of here, but thank you for this.
You bet. Take care, Dave.
AMI.ca/now blog for more information on those stories. That's Becky Czar coming up after the break. We'll catch up with Mike Ross for the regional news update. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's a Thursday edition of Now with Dave Brown on AMI. I am indeed Dave Brown, and it's May the 19th, 2022. Coming up in the second hour of the show, Stephen Scott of Double Tap Canada will discuss a few of the new accessibility features that are rolling out for Apple products and devices. And we'll also catch up with Sylvie Fiquette, the Pacific Regional Report. She'll talk about a documentary that looks into a rejected inclusive housing project in South Surrey, BC. Just before I give things over to Mike Ross for the regional news update, there's a few news stories that I thought you might find interesting. Yesterday, we shared the news that Finland and Sweden are formally seeking membership in NATO as a result of the Russia-Ukraine war. However, some roadblocks already appear to be forming. Turkey appears to have concerns about the two Nordic countries joining the alliance. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu offered mixed signals during a meeting with U.S. Secretary Antony Blinken.
Even before this war, but with regards to these possible candidates or already candidate countries, you know, we have also legitimate security concerns that they have been supporting terrorist organizations, and there are also export restrictions on defense products.
Objections from Turkey could delay Finland and Sweden's extension to the alliance. Let's go with another American story here that I thought was interesting and required a little bit of an explainer. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security is putting a pause on the launch of a board tasked with battling disinformation. Tim McGuire explains.
The Disinformation Governance Board has been roundly criticized from its inception, sparking concerns about free speech and the spread of, well, disinformation about the board's mission. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
It was never about censorship, policing speech, or removing content from anywhere.
Jean-Pierre adding Homeland Security's effort to offset and stop disinformation has been ongoing and will continue.
The departments work across several administrations to address disinformation that threatens the security of our country is critical, and that will indeed continue.
Board Director Nita Jankowicz resigned, later telling the AP she has been the target of online death threats, as well as sexist and anti-Semitic attacks. Republicans have been hammering at the board since its inception, calling it Orwellian and a political tool. Tim McGuire, Washington.
And let's come back to Canada, where Stats Canada says women made up about 19% of corporate board seats in 2019, an increase from about 18% the year before. Allison Venditti of Moms at Work is not expecting more progress anytime soon.
During the pandemic, they showed that women's, you know, household responsibilities, even for like senior executive women, doubled. There's no space and time to do board work at this moment in time unless you're very committed to it or you're required to do it by your job or you're doing it for a status reason. And most women aren't doing it for those reasons.
Instead of taking on board seats, Venditti has noticed more women opting to support or run women-led ventures and startups. Let's hand things over to Mike Ross. He's here with the regional news update.
Thanks, Dave. We'll begin in British Columbia, and a BC Supreme Court judge is expected to deliver her decision today in the case of the provincial legislature's former clerk, who's accused of misspending money from the public purse. Craig James is charged with fraud and breach of trust relating to his claim of a retirement benefit, personal expenses, and the purchase and storage of a wood splitter. Crown prosecutors have argued James used his position, which they likened to the CEO of the Legislative Assembly, to take advantage of weakness in policy to enrich himself. However, the defense claims James was transparent with each of his claims, which was overseen by multiple responsible individuals who raised only a handful of questions over a half decade and never lodged a complaint. To the prairies, about 11,000 members of the Manitoba government and General Employees Union will be getting a raise. An arbitration board has awarded the union a four-year collective agreement with retroactive pay increases after a court fight over provincial wage freeze legislation. The contract will grant the union members pay increases that amount to about 5.5%. In April of 2021, the Manitoba Court of Appeal said the government was unreasonable when it refused to allow the union contract to go to binding arbitration. To Ontario next, and Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca is calling for the New Democrats to stop criticizing his party's candidates, calling the strategy, quote, desperation tactics. Del Duca refused to comment yesterday when asked about allegations raised by the NDP that the Liberal candidate in Chatham-Kent Leamington was fraudulently registered for the June 2nd election. The accusations follow criticism raised by the NDP about other Liberal candidates who were dropped before last week's nomination deadline. The Liberal leader said he was disappointed the New Democrats were attacking him, while Horvath said the candidate nomination issue is a serious one that Del Duca should respond to. Advanced voting locations are opening across the province today. Venues are open daily from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. until May 28th for those wishing to cast early ballots for the June 2nd election. The party leaders are fanning out across the province today. New Democrat leader Andrea Horvath is set to visit Northern Ontario, while Progressive Conservative leader Doug Ford is scheduled to be in the Niagara region. Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca is in Mississauga, while Green leader Mike Schreiner is isolating at home after testing positive for COVID-19. To the Atlantic region, a retired RCMP officer who led much of the response to the 2020 mass shooting that left 22 dead in Nova Scotia has testified that spotty radio service posed challenges as Mounties chased a murderous suspect. Jeff West was the critical incident commander based in a fire hall west of Truro, Nova Scotia, from 1:19 a.m. until 20 10:20 a.m., pardon me, on April 19th, while Kevin Surrett, a retired staff sergeant who also testified yesterday, was supporting West. West said that when he took over command, he couldn't broadcast over the police network from his portable radio for 4 minutes until he stood next to a window. He said that's problematic, that the portable radios lacked the power to allow a critical incident commander to announce his presence. And those are your top regional headlines going coast to coast across the country.
So, Mike, in the first hour, I had to race you off the airwaves because I had to make sure there was time for porcupine and bear talk with Becky Czar. But we didn't get a chance beyond exploring the daily poll, which folks can find at AMI Audio on Twitter or Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook, in regards to whether or not a prime minister or premier stepping down should cause an immediate election call. But, Mike, we didn't give you a chance to actually offer up your thoughts on what's going on in Alberta politics right now.
Well, I'm more interested about what happens moving forward here, because, you know, Jason Kenney was brought in as the unifier of the conservative movement. Now, with him on the outs, you know, Brian Jean is a guy who's going to make a move here. But Brian Jean is also a guy who was at sort of one extreme wing of
part of the ouster.
That's right. And part of that Wild Rose party, et cetera, et cetera. So are you really still going to have a united conservative party? Is it still going to be the UCP? Or are we going to once again see sort of these fractures within the Conservative Party in Alberta? I will say this about Jason Kenney's decision to resign. I saw him on Question Period on CTV a couple of weeks ago, and he was asked directly, if you get 51% of the vote, will you resign? And it was interesting because at the time he said he would make his judgment once those results came in. But that he felt that, hey, 51% is enough to win me government. Why would it not be enough for me to stay on as premier? I think once he made that pronunciation and that pronouncement, I think people may have gotten into his ear a little bit and said, you know, 51% is pretty slim when you're the leader.
Yeah.
It's really a slim margin. So I think some of the insiders, some of his confidants and advisors probably got to him after that. And hey, he saw the results, and I think he made the right decision because it was just going to continue to dog him, right? Mm-hmm. Brian Jean was not going away. And in fact, now after winning the by-election, he's in the government.
That's right.
So he's not making, you know, Brian Jean isn't making these plans and these attacks from outside of the party. He's right there in the legislature.
The call is coming from inside the
probably
house.
A good move.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good move by Jason Kenney.
Yeah, Mike, the 51% thing, that was something that Craig Oliver identified yesterday. He said, typically a party leader, if they don't have 70 to 75% support within the party, they're going to have a tough time trying to keep that thing together and manage and whip votes and do what needs to be done. Mike, thank you for this.
Thank you, Dave.
Let's go from one kind of battle within Alberta to the Battle of Alberta with Jeff Ryman in a Sports Chats. Jeff, we don't always look backwards on what happened the night previous in sports, but I think it's impossible not to acknowledge the highest scoring hockey playoff game in 15 years. Wildness between the Edmonton Oilers and Calgary Flames. 9-6 final score for the Flameskis.
Dave, I hope you took the over if you were betting on the game
yesterday.
I
told you guys yesterday.
I know. I remember that, Dave. Could have, if you listen to Dave Brown, you could have won probably a decent chunk of change there by taking the over. And I'm pretty sure Calgary covered it by themselves.
That's only if you listen to a couple of my betting suggestions. Yeah. Don't listen to all of them, just the good ones.
Yeah, absolutely. But like I said, I think Calgary covered that by themselves. They covered the spread basically by themselves, putting up almost double digits. It was actually kind of funny. After the game, Daryl Sutter said, "We missed the conversion because, you know, they had 9 points. You know, he was looking to get 10, so therefore it'd be a touchdown and a field goal." But nonetheless, it was basically a baseball score or even a low-scoring CFL game or something that took place yesterday. And just craziness, Dave. Like within 30 seconds of the game, I think it was 2-0, then it was 3-0, and then it was 5-1 at one point, and then at one point again it was 6-5. Like,
well, it was 6-6. Edmonton tied the game 25 seconds into the third period.
Like bizarre craziness coming from that game yesterday. I don't know how much of battling was going on. It was more so just offense going on. So, you know, if you like the high scoring game, that was probably the ideal game for you. And all the stars came out to show. I mean, Connor McDavid was in on 4 of those 6 goals by the Edmonton Oilers. Matthew Tkachuk, hat trick.
Coleman, for the free agent acquisition of Blake Coleman, Stanley Cup champion with Tampa Bay the last 2 years. He popped in 2 goals in the second period that I thought were going to ice the game, and it turned out not so much.
It was just a weird game, although I kind of enjoyed it seeing that many goals. 15 goals is a lot. I wonder how many more they have in them throughout the rest of the series.
If you take the other 3 game ones in this round, all of those teams combined for 13 goals, and Edmonton and Calgary put up 15 last night. Jeff, it was one of those things where at 3-0, 6 minutes into the game, I said, okay, not really going to focus on this. I'll have it on the background while I work out. Around the time it was time to get into the shower, it was 5-1. I thought, okay, I can actually turn this TV off. So I turned the TV off, went to take my shower before bed, and then I looked at my phone as I was plugging in my phone and setting my alarm clock for this morning. Oh, 6-5 going into the third. Okay, TV's got to go back on. So the TV goes back on. Edmonton scores the goal to make it 6-6. Rasmus Anderson, just a few seconds later, makes it 7-6. But now I'm hooked. It's like 11:51. I'm in bed. I'm watching the game on TV. Terrible night's sleep. Incredible hockey game. Stick it to my veins.
Dave just throwing in there, you know, working out while watching the game.
Yeah, you got to pump the guns, Mr. Ryman.
And staying up way past your bedtime. I'm sure there's a bunch of Java going through your system this
a little
morning.
Bit. Teensy bit. Yeah. Teensy bit of Java
but
rolling
you're
through.
You're right. I mean, it was one of those games. And I agreed. Like, even when it was 3-0, like, just a few minutes into the game, I'm like, That's probably it. Like, it's usually really hard to come back from a deficit that early in the game. But nonetheless, Edmonton was able to do that, obviously lost the game. You know, that was the outcome, 9-6.
But if I'm like, Calgary, I've got cause for concern because Jacob Markstrom allowed 6 goals on 19 shots.
Yeah, I mean, that one Leon Draisaitl goal, when it was kind of like a 2-on-1 with McDavid, and I understand it's a 2-on-1 with Connor McDavid, but it was a little bit of a weaker goal, and that's something that Jacob Markstrom has to clean up. And then Edmonton on the other side, I mean, Mike Smith was pulled after
6 minutes.
You know, the first 6 minutes, letting in 3 goals on 8 shots or something.
He was the goalie who allowed the least goals last night, though. So, you know.
I mean, Edmonton's got some thinking to do. Jay Woodcroft has to go back to the drawing board and figure out which starter is going to actually get the start come the next game, game 2. So, yeah, lots of question marks. This is a really intriguing matchup. And it's so weird, like you said, Dave, the other matchups, all 3 other games that took place prior were very close and somewhat low scoring. And it was funny because the game versus Carolina and New York was 1-0 for like the longest time. Mm-hmm. And then Carolina tied it up late and then scored in overtime. It was a 2-1 game, really defensive. And then you get the complete opposite with the nightcap between the Battle of Alberta.
No, give me more of that, man. Give me way more of that. Yep, Jeff, I know you want to preview a couple of the hockey games tonight, but I do want to make mention that one of the golf majors officially starts today, the PGA Championship. Mm-hmm. So that's one to keep your eye on TSN as well. A lot of exciting golfers playing well, including someone like Jordan Spieth, who yesterday was talking about wanting to complete the Grand Slam. And people forget, back in 2015, 2016, Jordan Spieth was the best golfer in the world, was leading the 2016 Masters, has had a meltdown, and has had little bubbles here and there, starting to find his game again 5 years later. So he's still a young man, still under 30 years old. Jordan Spieth still on that comeback trail. So golf world, always exciting. But Jeff, give me a couple quick thoughts on the hockey games tonight, starting with, is it Tampa in Florida tonight?
Yep. Yep, Tampa and Florida, 4-1 game. I thought Florida looked really, really good, at least throughout the first half of that of that game in game number one, which took place in Sunrise, Florida. So they do have home ice advantage. It didn't come to a very much advantage for them the other night. You don't want to go down 0-2 in a series. I think it's plain and simple. Everybody knows that, especially at home. You can't go down 0-2. I think Florida comes out. But, Dave, like we've been mentioning, Tampa Bay with that goaltending and Andrei Vasilevskiy, he looked phenomenal in game one. Florida came out, like I said, in that first period, they had multiple scoring chances. We're only able to get one by Vasilevskiy. So, you know, it's well, easier
they thought, they thought they had two, but one was called back because it didn't actually go in the nets.
I think what happened was it hit the netting behind the net.
Yeah.
And then it came back out, and so that goal was called back, which would have tied the game at two and could have changed the outcome of that game. But yeah, Vasilevskiy, my goodness, like what a goaltender he is. I mean,
also, we say Florida, it time and time again. If you're Florida, maybe Mackenzie Weegar, don't take a penalty 28 seconds into the game.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, Nikita Kucherov, that move on Aaron Ekblad, my goodness. Yeah. Like, Aaron Ekblad is one of the top defensemen in the entire NHL and just like completely made him look clueless on that play. Easy pass to Corey Perry for a beautiful, beautiful goal. So I think this might be the most intriguing matchup. I know Calgary and Edmonton might sway my opinion from yesterday. But this Florida series, like I said, Florida cannot go down 0-2 against the two-time reigning champion Tampa Bay Lightning.
Jeff, we're going to run out of time here, but St. Louis held their own against Colorado on Monday on Tuesday in the sense that Jordan Binnington made over 50 saves to keep them in the game. They can't play again like that tonight and expect to win the game.
They scored first in that game, too, and usually if you score first, that is a very good sign in the playoffs. Although, when you're going against Colorado again, offense, offense, offense from the Colorado Avalanche. Binnington, like you said, kept them in it. Otherwise, I think it would have been a lot worse of an outcome for St. Louis. So it'll be interesting to see how they bounce back tonight, Dave.
Jeff, thank you for this, man. I know you're off this off tomorrow, so have a great long, long weekend.
You too, Dave. See you on, I guess, Tuesday.
That's right. That's Jeff Ryman. He's at the AMI Sports Desk. Sam Robinson is at the AMI Weather Desk.
Thanks, Dave. And here's your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. Starting off as we do in this hour, in Cornerbrook, Newfoundland. You've got a few showers ending late this morning, then clearing throughout the rest of the day, the high 9 degrees. Moving to Charlottetown, PEI, mainly sunny, the high 15 degrees. In St. John, New Brunswick, mainly sunny, increasing cloudiness late this afternoon, the high 12 degrees. Over to Quebec City. This morning, mainly cloudy. The high, 18 degrees. And as well, I'd mentioned yesterday, there is a continuing storm surge warning along the banks of the St. Lawrence Seaway. Moving over to Toronto, a few showers ending this morning, then cloudy. The high in Toronto today, 22 degrees. Up to the Sault Ste. Marie. Showers ending this morning, then cloudy with 60% of showers this afternoon, 60% chance of showers this afternoon, the high 20 degrees. Over to the prairies, and in Brandon, Manitoba, it's cloudy this morning. Risk of a thunderstorm this afternoon, the high 11 degrees. Over to Regina, showers this morning. Risk of a thunderstorm this afternoon, the high 14 degrees. Into Alberta, and Lethbridge is cloudy this morning, rain beginning near noon, the high 11 degrees. Into Red Deer, it's rainy this morning, the high 9 degrees. Up to the territories, and in Whitehorse, it's sunny this morning. Then a mix of sun and cloud with 30% chance of showers late this afternoon, the high 14 degrees. Down to Kelowna, it's mainly cloudy this morning, 40% chance of showers, the high 15 degrees. And finally, in Vancouver, it's mainly sunny, the high 13 degrees. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Sam. We'll talk to you a little bit later for the Entertainment Report. We'll talk to Stephen Scott next. He's got details about accessibility features coming to Apple products and devices. But first, Google is re-dipping their toe into the technology waters, a bunch of different ones, including augmented reality. Here's Sherry Preston with Tech Trends.
In 2013, Google rolled out Glass, a pair of augmented reality glasses that could project information directly onto the lenses, things like directions, pictures, and text.
Google Glass was like, we're going to try and like literally reinvent how you live your life.
Android authority C. Scott Brown says Glass is regarded as one of Google's biggest misfires, sparking privacy and safety concerns. But now Google says it's working on another AR project, a new video from Google showing specs that can hear conversations and project language translations onto the lenses in real time.
Abandoning the idea of what they did with Google Glass, which is trying to make it an augmented reality multi-tool. Instead, it appears anyway to be focusing just on one thing, which is the ability to communicate with someone who doesn't speak your language directly face to face.
It's just a concept for now, which means no release date yet. With Tech Trends, I'm Sherry Preston, ABC News.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's talk tech with Stephen Scott of Double Tap Canada. Of course, you can find that program Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. And you can find Stephen in Glasgow, Scotland. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm well. Nice to chat with you as always. And Stephen, in honor of Global Accessibility Awareness Day, your favorite company, Apple, is previewing several new accessibility features coming down the pipeline. Let's start here, Stephen. What is door detection?
Oh, it's the greatest feature ever made, Dave. So, you know, I don't know about you, right? I find often it's the last 10 yards of any journey I do, which is the most challenging. So whenever I go out, I might get a taxi, an Uber, whatever it might be, to my destination. I get out the taxi, I get out the cab, and I try and find the door of the place I'm trying to get to. And I can't find the door.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what door detection is.
And they're making
it
harder, Stephen. They're like making all these big glass walls where the door looks like the rest of the wall.
Yeah. And that's the thing, right? Because you might think to yourself, well, how is a phone going to detect a door? Well, of course, it's using all the latest technology, including LiDAR, including artificial intelligence, augmented reality. It's using all of that to be able to showcase how to see the door. Now, not only can it see the door, Dave, it can tell if the door should be pushed open, pulled open. If it's a sliding door, it can even tell you if the door is open as well. Any text on the door, maybe, for example, if it's a hotel, what door number it is. You know, I don't know how many times you've done this. You go to a hotel and you're either walking around with your face against every single door.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to see what the number is. Or, you know, you have to ask someone and you think, well, where is it? And how can I find it myself? Well, all this is solved by door detection. Only available, though, on the iPhone 12 Pro and the iPhone 13 Pro models,
because
the Pro models only have LiDAR.
Right, so you need the LiDAR to make this work. That's the sort of the key that unlocks the ability of this technology.
Yeah,
the
hotel, so far, anyway, that may change.
Yeah, the hotel thing that you identify is something that a few folks that I've worked with over the years have explained to me their methods. Grant Hardy, the reporter for our Vancouver bureau, likes to put a rubber band on doorknobs so that if he has to touch the doorknobs, he can at least figure out which one is his via rubber band, unless, of course, housekeeping decides, where'd this come from?
To take and it away. Moves it. Yeah, exactly. That's the problem. And as a friend of mine said, it's really simple. He said, I find doors all the time. I just walk into them. That's another way of doing it.
That is definitely one way of doing it. And, you know, thankfully, if you're blind or legally blind, you may not see the things that people don't want you to see. Yes, let's jump over to the Apple Watch, Stephen. A couple features being launched here. What is the mirroring feature?
So this might seem a bit odd, where you can now mirror your Apple Watch onto your iPhone. And you might think, well, why would you want to do that? But let's think about people who may not be able to physically look down at their Apple Watch or be able to lift their arm up to look at their Apple Watch. You can now have the phone, say, for example, it's mounted in a cradle, perhaps on a wheelchair in front of you. Then you would be able to see what's on the watch screen. Now, you again might think, well, okay, but then why wouldn't you just use the phone? why would you need the watch? Well, of course, the watch brings a lot of health benefits. It can check your blood oxygen level. It can check your resting heart rate, all of that great stuff. So there's many reasons why you might want to have a watch. And lots of people in wheelchairs do exercise. There's lots of wheelchair exercises you can have. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, people might want to have the watch, but need access to it via their iPhone. This is a really smart and a really interesting feature.
What about another feature being unlocked here called Quick Actions?
So this was an interesting one because Quick Actions, you know, has been on the Mac for a while in many different forms. But this particular version relates to Assistive Touch, which you and I talked about a while ago when it was launched, last year, in fact, when it was launched, which is Assistive Touch allows you to essentially use your hand to control your watch without touching the watch. So by simply squeezing your hand, maybe making a punch fist, or perhaps maybe taking your index finger and your thumb and bringing them together, that can actually create a gesture that your watch will recognize. I mean, how cool is that, right? Yeah. Well, they've added in these new quick actions, which are essentially extensions of that. So now they've added a double pinch gesture, and you can customize a lot of this stuff. So you could say, for example, well, I'd like it to make it so that I could double pinch, which means maybe take my index finger and my thumb and bring them together twice. That could answer a call. It could end a call. It could maybe skip a track of music that's playing. You know, stop and start songs in my playlist. You know, those kind of things. And they're bringing in more and more of these gestures. This is the latest one.
Mm. The other day we were talking about some live captioning being brought into Windows 11. Well, Apple is also talking about live captioning on the iPhone, iPad, and Mac. What are they trying to roll out here?
And as usual, Dave, when Apple do it right. So, you know, they're bringing in the live. Now, this is cool because, of course, again, it's the same feature set you would expect on Windows and on, I guess, Chromebooks as well through Google, right? But this is a bit more because even on like a FaceTime call, you can now get live transcriptions of that call in real time. You can even type responses on a phone call. If you're deaf and you're on a phone call with someone, you can type a response and that can be spoken aloud to someone who can hear on the other end. You know, that's impressive stuff. If this is going to work the way we hope it does, and of course, this is all just features we've heard about. We haven't demoed these in the real world. None of these features are going to show up until later in the year. You know, it's really interesting to see how this could develop, but they really are integrating it deep into every single part of the iPhone and Mac ecosystem.
Mm. Stephen, we're a little tight on time here, but I know you've got a couple more features to talk about. So let's go a little rapid fire on these.
Go on then.
The Buddy Controller.
Buddy controller. So if you are a game player, you like to play games and you've got a controller, maybe you struggle a little bit with that, then you can buddy up with someone who has a controller as well, and they can take part in the game with you. So you can team play, essentially, but with support.
I'm going to use one of the trigger words here for a second. Siri pause time.
Oh, well, this is the great feature because what this allows you to do is, you know, sometimes you may be just thinking a little bit about what you want to ask your smart assistant.
Oh, yeah.
It just cuts off and it's like, oh, I haven't finished yet. You've got to go through this whole process again. Mm-hmm, well, mm-hmm. With Siri pause time, it'll give you a little bit more time just to give your answer, which is great for people with speech problems. And it's great for people like me who find it hard to form a sentence sometimes in the time it's allocated or allotted to.
Yeah, because the words you choose for your assistant matter if you want to get the results or the action that you need. And yeah, sometimes the brain is not always firing at full cylinders like we hope it would.
Mine certainly isn't.
What about Apple Books? What's being rolled out in the Apple Books platform?
Not a lot here. This is just more customization options. Apple Books was one of the first apps to have so many customization options, font size, background color, all of that. And they're just building on that. And I think a lot of people are hoping this will extend out to other applications as well.
Stephen, just as we're wrapping up here, is there a timeline for these being rolled out? Some of them already out. Some of them might be software updates, new devices. What's sort of the rough timeline or hodgepodge here?
So they say fall, roughly, but we know already that iOS 16 is being delayed a little bit. So it's likely we'll probably see iOS 16 coming out around September time, mid-September possibly, and then those features should be part of that or rolled out. Now, they don't all come out at the same time. Universal Control was launched last year. It's still in beta. In fact, it's just come out of beta and will be becoming available soon. That's nearly a year since it was announced. These things don't always appear instantly, but they will be out this year. We hope, and we're told so far that they will be out this year, late this year.
Stephen, thank you for this. We always appreciate it.
You didn't even get to the bit where I could tell you about my Samsung watch, and I knew you'd want to hear about this.
Let's save it. Let's save it for 2 weeks. Two weeks down the stretch.
I've only just got it. So yeah, let's do this in a couple of weeks when I've had a chance to play with it to tell you how bad it is.
Oh, I look forward to it. Stephen, thank you for this.
Thanks, Dave. Take care.
That's Stephen Scott. He's one of the hosts of Double Tap Canada. You can find the program Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio, or you can download the podcast. Don't forget, you can also catch The Pulse with Joita Gupta Saturdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. This week, she'll be talking to Michael Fair about his book, Personal Power, which is designed to help blind iPhone users get the most out of their device. That's The Pulse, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. You can also download the podcast on your favorite podcast platform, and you can catch Joita as part of our news panel tomorrow. Coming up next, Sam Robinson will be here with the Entertainment Report. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Let's catch up with Sylvie Fiquette for the Pacific Regional Report. Sylvie is a content development specialist for AMI based in Vancouver. Hey, good morning, Sylvie.
Hey, good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm well. Always nice to chat with you. And Sylvie, the first topic you've got for us today is about inclusive, affordable housing. A documentary called Lauren's Story is going to examine a housing project that was rejected in South Surrey, BC. So Sylvie, before we talk about the documentary itself, give me a little bit more insight into this project that was rejected in South Surrey.
Yeah, it's really too bad, Dave. I wish I had better news. This developer in South Surrey was intending to construct a 91-unit, six-story complex. The hope for the inclusive housing in South Surrey was really trending, and so many people were looking forward to it. The proposal, the building's called Harmony. It was the goals were to include much needed housing for people with disabilities in the community, but sadly was rejected by Surrey City Council last July. The housing project had proposed a combination of inclusive, affordable, and close to market rate units. Those behind the project said more than 200 people had expressed interest in calling Harmony their future home.
Yeah, for so long, Sylvie, places like Surrey is where people could go to find affordable housing in the Vancouver area. It was right near the SkyTrain. It was fairly easy to get downtown from Surrey. And now just more and more, the sprawl is happening where now even in Coquitlam, condos are going for $500,000, $750,000. And you look at these opportunities, like this project, is trying to bridge some of those gaps and create inclusive, affordable housing, especially where people with disabilities who may require public transit can actually get access to it, and it's getting rejected. It's really too bad.
It really is, Dave. And you know, when you're saying as far out as Coquitlam, properties and housing are going for, you know, $750,000, actually even further out in Abbotsford, they're going for a townhouse for over $1 million.
Yeah.
So it's very, very challenging to find affordable housing. I know that's true for most cities across, major cities across Canada, but it keeps going up, and there's almost like, where's the ceiling?
Yeah. Sylvie, let's talk a bit about this documentary, because it really is taking a look at how the rejection of this project is impacting the community and maybe some of the positive impacts it would have had on the community. So when and where does it premiere?
Yeah, so this documentary titled Lauren's Story is sponsored by Unity. It's a partnership of groups that are supporting people with disabilities, and they have multiple services, including a housing society. So Lauren Simpson is a community leader who worked on Surrey's housing needs report, and she was supporting other people with disabilities to contribute to the project. Lauren's story is powerful. The documentary explores some of the reasons reasons potentially why the city rejected the project, and it will premiere on May 28th at the Inclusion BC Conference, being held through May 26th to the 28th at the Sheraton Vancouver Guildford Hotel in Surrey. Simpson is going to be presenting a keynote introducing the documentary at the premiere event.
Sylvie, you mentioned that right now, due to the rejection of this project, it's some bad news, but is there any sense from those behind the project or this documentary that there's any potential positive movement here?
Yes. So I think the sponsors of the documentary are hoping for that it'll create a bit of a buzz and bring attention to the rejected inclusive housing project within the community. Doug Tennant, who's the CEO of Unity, shared that he felt council's decision was really cold-hearted. He's hopeful the documentary will build awareness around the continued need for such housing. And, you know, his comments are kind of telling. He said that Lauren's story doesn't have a happy ending yet, but it may have a happy ending eventually. So that, to me, indicates that with advocacy and a strategy to improve consultation with neighbors living in the area and building greater public support may impact council's decision regarding these sorts of projects in the future.
Sylvie, that story still remains untold, but there is a positive story you wanted to share with us today about a student at Simon Fraser University who won a national award for developing an interactive board game called Cityscape. So before we get into the game itself, what is the award and who won it?
Yeah, sorry, my script is falling here.
This happens to the best of us, Sylvia. Believe me, my papers go everywhere by the end of the day.
Yeah. So what I wanted to say is, do you like my tie-in with city planning here?
I do, Dave. That was well done. I do enjoy connective tissue.
Yes. So a Simon Fraser University graduate student has been helping develop an interactive board game that shows in real time how various decisions to build office towers, parks, or walkways affect us. And she's been honored by a National Research Council for her work involving cities and sound. The Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council named Zora Farron one of its 5 national award winners in the 2022 Storytellers Challenge for her work helping to create the first of its kind game, Cityscape. Farron said that she feels the sensory experience of a large city is very intense. Sound enters our brain whether we want it to or not. We don't have options to eliminate a lot of the clutter of the urban soundscape. So she's come up with this really inventive game.
So how does the game work?
Yeah, Farron's game, Cityscape, connects acoustic ecology with city planning. It's played on a 6-sided board with a built-in speaker at its center. Players get cards depicting various roles, such as a developer, an activist, even a pigeon. The aim is to create an environment with sounds that are livable. So depending on the player's choice, they place the card or disc into the slot where with this interactive game, and the speaker shifts the player's choice. So you may hear birds chirping in trees, or you may hear traffic. It really depends on how you're designing and moving these discs on the board.
It doesn't quite sound as complex as Prisoners of Catan, but I think I'm going to have to see the rule sheet exactly how to play this game. Sylvie, we've only got about 30 seconds here, but what does she feel the overall impact of this game could be?
Yeah, so she said Cityscape aims to include accessibility, inclusivity, cultural heritage, and community resilience. And she said we just need to make conscious urban design choices that can ensure better livability for everyone. And that the game, there's an opportunity to shape our urban landscape or soundscape. Inclusive city planning can't be ignored any longer. Everything we build and make needs to be done in sync with the shifting needs of the ecological balance for all impacted. And I really like those statements. Mm-hmm. They just bring it front and center about kind of noise pollution.
There is something lovely this time of year, even when we're in the cities like you and I are, when you can actually hear the birds chirping instead of horns honking. Sylvie, thank you for this. Have a lovely long weekend.
Thanks. You too, Dave. Enjoy your long weekend.
That's Sylvie Fiquette, a content development specialist for AMI, joining us from beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia. That's all the time we have for the show today. We'll be back again tomorrow morning. Until then, I'm Dave Brown, reminding you to play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.